Jenna, thank you. That was beautiful. That's the first time I think you've done that. I don't know. I certainly hope it's not the last. Is profound from the lyrics and your beautiful voice combined to do something very special. And I know you guys are messing with me. People are sitting in the different places. Karen and Mark are usually over there. Jean and her daughters are always over there, and now you're over here. I don't know what this is. Welcome. Thank you all for coming out today. It's a beautiful, beautiful day, and thank you for joining us. We're continuing our October theme of prosperity. The title of my talk today is Strong Brew. Hopefully we're going to take some time to learn how to turn our buckets right side up. And I'm going to talk about three things. First, I'm going to read a little bit about from what we believe. Then I'm going to talk about the metaphysical laws that we can use in our lives for prosperity and abundance. And then finally, I've got one practical step that we can all take. But I want to start off with a story. Imagine that, Don telling a story. A lady by the name of Carol Alston Stiles wrote in the January issue of Guidepost Magazine a story about her husband. He was at a stop sign and a motorist coming opposite direction at a high rate of speed veered off the road and T-boned him, came right into his vehicle, and he suffered numerous injuries, but the worst injury that he suffered was a TBI or traumatic brain injury. Her husband, Peter, was a real typical A personality type guy, a real charger. He was one that was, working 50 and 60 hours a week, always had a cell phone on when he wasn't in a meeting or in a conference or directing something. He had a really sharp mind, always driven. He could calculate the amortization on a 30-year note in his head, just a real charging guy. He made a lot of money, so Carol didn't have to work. She could stay home. I think she did some kind of graphic design while their son was in school, but it was more of a hobby, really, than it was anything for income. All of that changed. Peter struggled to remember how many quarters were in a dollar. And when looking at a family photo, he couldn't pick out his own niece. He struggled with life. Through physical therapy, rehabilitation, his body healed and he came back, but that traumatic brain injury continued to hold him captive. And he couldn't work, he couldn't return to his job. Of course, eventually his insurance ran out. And the worst part was that he knew he couldn't function like he used to. He was aware that he was functioning at a much lower level. And that sent him into a depression that was really, really difficult to get out of. One morning, as Carol was in their kitchen, grinding beans and making a cup of coffee, it kind of suddenly dawned on her. She remembered that Peter, the day before, had made the coffee, and he could remember enough to make the coffee. And she thought, well, if he can do that, that's one of the joys that they had as a couple, as they really enjoyed coffee together. And if he could do that, maybe he could do a little bit more. And then she thought she had read a thing earlier, and she remembered that about a kind of a new trend, sort of the fancy foodie thing is to roast your own coffee. You get a small roaster and you roast your own coffee. And she thought, well, maybe he could do that. So when he got up, she brought up the subject, well, maybe you could start roasting the coffee. And he pointed out they didn't have a roaster. And she thought, well, maybe we can do something. And she said, okay, Peter, you're in charge of finding a roaster. And so he got on the internet and he actually found a roaster. It was a small residential type thing. They went and got it and picked it up and brought it home. And he roasted the first batch of coffee that they had. And it came out great. I guess I've never done this, but when you put the beans in, the green beans, and you roast them, the oil comes to the outside and then they pop. It's almost like popcorn. And he roasted this coffee and they immediately ground it and brewed a pot of coffee. And it was just outstanding. Well, part of the brain that did not diminish for Peter was his drive. So over the next few days, they had more coffee than they knew what to do with. He was trying, you know, different temperatures and different lengths of time to be roasted, all looking to perfect this. And they started giving the coffee away. Their neighbors loved it. And their neighbors started chipping a little bit to help them to defray the cost of the green beans. Initially, they had done those first two or three batches just right in their kitchen. And she realized that wasn't going to happen. There was quite a bit of smoke involved and all their clothes were starting to smell like roasted coffee. So they moved out to the shed. He had a shed out back and they cleaned out the shed and they took the roaster out there and he started roasting in the shed. Well, after a couple of weeks, the city knocked on the door and said, you know, your neighbors are kind of complaining. We got to do something here. And so Carol realized that she was at a fork. She realized that she was a place where she's going to have to make a choice. And so she went within and she thought about it. She's a very devout woman. And she prayed for an answer to know what to do. And it became really clear to her that it was far more important for Peter to continue this than it was anything else. That he was a benefit as well as anybody could do this. So they made the decision. They bought a bigger roaster. They found an inexpensive warehouse that they could rent where the roasting would be allowed. And they moved in. They formed a small coffee company that provided fresh coffee to the grocery stores in their small town. They started doing custom orders. They did an order for a couple getting married in the Caribbean, Jamaican Me Crazy coffee. And they did that kind of stuff, and their business grew. And they had a total transformation from this. No, they didn't have the income level that they had before. But they had something more. Peter was able to be there with their son and go to his lacrosse games. They realized that maybe they'd been standing in the rain with their bucket upside down, and they were able to turn it over and really start catching all of the blessings that the divine has for us. They made a strong brew. Ernest Holmes, in 1927, wrote a piece called What I Believe. And he had been pestered so many times, what do you believe in this thing called religious science? What do you believe? And so he wrote a piece, and we have it on the wall in the back. They changed it in the next year to What We Believe. That wasn't very original, was it? Just take out the I and put in the we. But that's the way it's existed to this day, is What We Believe. And it's still there. And I want to read a little bit from that. We believe that the universal spirit, which is God, operates through a universal mind, which is the law of God, and that we are surrounded by this creative mind, which receives the direct impress of our thought and acts upon it. We believe in the healing of the sick through the power of this mind, and we believe in the control of conditions through the power of this mind. this is not some type of mental coercion. This is not something where I go into some kind of a state and I can somehow use my mind to cure you of an ailment or to bring prosperity and abundance to you. It is not some type of a mental coercion. It is the use of a law. Back when, I guess I wasn't a kid, years and years ago, I think it was the 70s, there was a TV show, and I don't remember the name, but the star was a genie, a real pretty girl, and she was married to a regular guy, and she could wiggle her nose and have, you know, that's not it. These things don't happen by wiggling your nose and having magic appear. But there is a law that absolutely deals with that. And I had this great plan for how I was going to present the how this law works and how it works in our lives. Then I thought, well, that's kind of dumb, because Ernest Holmes did a great job of that and the thing that he called the divine creative process. And we have it today, which we know as our teaching symbol. Oh, it's green. It's our teaching symbol. And you notice that it's a circle. And that circle represents God. That is not a fence that is around God, that bounds God anyway. It's a circle because it has no beginning and no end. And that is the nature of God. It has no beginning and no end. It is infinite in its nature. And we kind of tend to divide it into three parts, not because God can be divided, but because it helps those of us with finite minds to be able to grasp a little bit about it. And the top portion is what we tend to think of as thought, or the beginning. It is the unformed substance. The middle portion is the law. That is the creative force. That is the law that responds to the thought. And the bottom portion is the world of effect. That is the material world in which we live. That is all of the effects, the conditions that we live in. We like to think of it in terms of seed, soil, plant. If you have a seed on the top, seed in the form of an idea, you put that into the creative medium, which is the middle portion, which can be thought of as the soil, and out comes a plant. So if you plant tomato seeds, you can expect to get tomatoes. If you plant potatoes, you can expect to get potatoes. Sometimes we like to think that we can plant an apple tree and harvest oranges. Doesn't work that way. We need to look at what we are harvesting in the experience of our lives in order to determine what it is we've planted, because we don't always know what it is that we have planted. But this is how the divine creative process works. And there are certain metaphysical laws that deal with this divine creative process. And I'm going to talk about four of them today, and generally in terms of how they relate to prosperity and abundance. The first is what Ernest Holmes defined as the law of cause and effect. And very simply stated, the law of cause and effect states that every effect originated as a cause. Every effect comes from cause. The next layer down is that the precedent of all matter is thought. The precedent of everything that is originated in thought, in mind. You know, I have my water bottle down there. That was originally somebody's idea. Oh, we can make it clear, and that way you can see how much water is in it. We'll put a little flipper flap on the top so that a clumsy minister knocks it over, it doesn't make a giant spill on the floor like he did the first time. But they came up with some ideas that to make it useful to us. There was a thought, and they took it to a manufacturer, and it was actually made. But that originated, for that water bottle, originated in mind. Our lives are the outpicturing of our thoughts and beliefs. If we have a belief that we're not good enough, it doesn't make any difference how hard we work or what we do or what kind of job we have or what our income is. We are never going to have enough because we have a belief that we're not worthy of it. So if we're in a situation where we are struggling in order to live, we can take a look at our beliefs the hidden beliefs that are behind it, that are creating it. That the precedent of all effect is thought. Now, the second piece goes right along with it. Ernest Holmes called it the law of correspondence, and that is that the manifestation is the mental equivalent of our thoughts. The manifestation is the mental equivalent of our thoughts. That is, if we imagine ourselves driving an old clunker, belching smoke and limping down the road, that's pretty much what we're going to be driving. But if we can imagine ourselves driving down the road in reliable transportation that gets us from A to B, then that's what we're going to experience. Another fault that we sometimes run into, a trap that we make for ourselves, is we think, oh, well, I want a fancy red sports car. And I want it to be a luxury fancy red sports car. Rather than go for the feeling tone of reliability and functionality, we go for the fancy red sports car. And I remember a guy had exactly that situation, and he talked about that, and his treatment was for a fancy red sports car. And he got it. Matchbox. It was a really nice little fancy red sports car. And he was still driving around a clunker that was belching smoke and barely getting him from A to B. We go for the feeling tone that we can do it, because by the law of correspondence, the manifestation is the mental equivalent of our thoughts. The third law that I want to talk about is the law of attraction. And that's the one that got all the fame with, you know, the movie The Secret and all of that kind of stuff. And simply stated, the law of attraction is that like attracts like. Now, that's opposite of what we're taught in science and the law of magnetism, where like repels like and opposites attract. This is that like attracts like. And if you have a belief system that is prosperous in nature, and you absolutely know that you live in a prosperous universe and that you are never going to worry for shelter, you're never going to worry for a bed to sleep in, you're never going to worry for enough to eat, that is exactly what you're going to attract into your life. If, on the other hand, if you were constantly in fear, if you were constantly, am I going to even have a place to sleep tonight? Then that's what you're going to manifest, because like attracts like. So all these laws are very closely interrelated. The last law that I'm going to talk about is the law of circulation. And as I thought about the best way to present that, it really occurred to me, the great wayshower Jesus taught through the use of parables. And one of the most powerful parables that he taught through, in my opinion, was known as the parable of the slothful servant, or the parable of the talents. And the Cliff Notes version of this parable is that a rich landowner was going to go off on a trip, and he was going to be gone for an extended period of time. And so he called in some of his servants. And the first servant that he called in, he had quite a bit of faith in this guy, and he gave him 5 talents. And he said, I want you to take care of this for me while I'm gone. And a talent is a measure typically of silver. And I think in today's money, that had probably translated into about $250,000. It's a lot. I mean, it was many pounds of silver. And then he called in a second servant. And he says, hey, I'm going to be going away for a long trip. I want you to take care of this for me. And he gave him 2 talents. Now you take care of it. And he says, yes, master, I will. And he called in a third servant. And he says, I'm going to give you 1 talent. I want you to guard this, take care of it. I'm going to be gone a while. Have it for me when I get back. Well, the first servant, after the master left, he went out and he traded with it. He bought and sold things. He invested. He did quite well with it. He turned the 5 talents into 10. The second servant did the same kind of thing. He went out and he traded with it. You know, he They were right on the Silk Road. He was able to buy spices and stuff and sell silk. Do it. He was able to trade and gain and profit from that. And he turned the 2 talents into 4 talents. And the third servant was afraid. And he didn't know what to do. And he was afraid he might lose some. So he got an old Folgers can and buried it in the backyard. Well, the master came back and he called the first servant in and he says, okay, how did you do with my 5 talents that I gave? And he says, well, I did quite well, master. I traded with that and I was able to increase it. And I went from 2 talents, or I went from 5 talents, and I increased it to 10. And the master said, oh, you're a wonderful servant. You're loyal and everything else. So I have given you a little responsibility. Going forward, I'm going to give you great responsibility. Called in the second servant, and he says, how did you do? Told him the same story. I doubled it. I turned it into 4. You are a loyal and thoughtful servant, and I have given you a little. Now I will give you a lot. And he called in the third servant, and he said, well, I know that you're not the most honest guy there ever was, and I didn't know what was going to happen, so I went out and I buried your 1 talent in the backyard. But when you came back, I dug it up, and here it is. And the master said, you are a lazy and slothful servant, and I'm taking this 1 talent away from you, and I'm giving it to the guy with 10. And I love the parables of Jesus because they go against sometimes what we would think. We would think, well, he was just really being conservative, wasn't he? He was just making sure he didn't lose that little bit that he had. But that isn't the message that Jesus was teaching in this parable. What Jesus was teaching about was the law of circulation. And that is that if you go out and circulate, if you take this and you put it forth into the universe, it's going to come back to you. It can come back doubled, it can come back tripled, it can come back tenfold. But if you put this out into the universe, it's going to come back to you. But if you hoard things, like old rusty bent nails, they're not going to come back to you. You might as well bury it in your backyard, because you're stagnating the flow of circulation. You're cutting down the flow. Those rusty nails could be recycled, melted down, bent, and turned into new nails. Some of you don't know the new nails, the rusty nails story, but that's a whole other story. When we hoard or hold on to things, circulation is restricted and life becomes stagnant. Which then leads me to the third thing. And I said that I was going to give you a practical step that you can take. And I got this from Reverend Guy. And Reverend Guy, that man could manifest. And he, you know, he understood these principles. And what he taught me was the 70-10-10-10 rule. And what he did is when he got his paycheck, the first thing that he did, he took 10% out and that went back to the center, went back to the church. The second 10% that he took out of that, he saved. And it's not hoarding. He was saving for a rainy day. He was saving for something that big that might come along that he couldn't foresee. The third 10% that he took out of that, he spent on himself. He gave 10% to himself to take care of himself, where he could waste it, he could do anything he wanted to, but it was his and he took care of himself with that 10%. And that left him 70% to live on, take care of all of his bills and all the other stuff. That might mean that he'd have to change his living arrangements, might have to do a lot of things, but he stuck by his 70-10-10-10. And I submit that that's a good way to look at life and to manage your savings. It gets you away from the constantly robbing from Peter to pay Paul to make every month's payments. I'm drawn back to the strong brew. I look at the lyrics of the special music. When things go wrong and my way is dark, When I lose my song and life breaks my heart, I go within my heart and soul. I start again knowing that I am whole. And you see, that's what Carol Halston Stiles did in the condition that she faced. She was able to step back from the depression of her husband, to step back from the appearance of lack and limitation and all of the other things that were coming at her from every direction, and to reform a new way of thinking, a new way of looking at her experience. She actually was using these laws. You don't have to understand electricity. You don't have to have a degree in electrical engineering to flip on the light switch. And that's what we're trying to teach here, is how to turn on the lights. And what she was able to do was to reframe how she thought about things and to reframe how Peter looked at things. They used the law of cause and effect. They used that law of correspondence, knowing that their picture of a thriving coffee company could come into manifestation. The law of attraction, having that positive outlook, the drive that was still within Peter, and harnessing that to make coffee and be of service to other people. So we can all do this. And the law of circulation is a part of it. So the next time you have a cup of coffee, remember that strong brew and that we can do this. And so with the awareness of the power that is within each and every one of us, the power that is our minds, I invite my colleagues, the practitioners, to join me in surrounding and holding our congregation in love and light, knowing that every thought becomes a prayer. And we hold the thought that we live in an abundant universe, and that is our divine right order. It is our gift to open up and turn our buckets right side up and accept all of the blessings that are pouring out from the universe at this and in every moment. Knowing that our thoughts become things. And as we face physical challenge and dis-ease, we can see beyond the dis-ease and know the truth. Know the truth that, yes, maybe that traumatic brain injury is still there, but what is left is still powerful. That what is left is still able to create, is still able to bring joy and happiness and peace and love. And knowing that as we interact with one another, we can set aside differences, we can set aside all seeming opposites, and know that as we come together as one, one people, one life, one mind, we can know that truth, that love is the essence of who each and every one of us are, and that every one of our relationships is grounded and founded in the very love of God. And so we just give thanks now. We give thanks for our awareness that we live in a magnificent universe and that we are all truly blessed at every moment. All praises be unto the one, and so it is.